The great Catholic translation called the Jerusalem Bible phrases it like this: I was by his side, a master craftsman, should be craftsperson, of course, delighting him day after day, at play everywhere in his world. So where are we headed with this rather convoluted and unusual introduction? Most of you know from experience in this room what it means, that the sermon will be unconventional and requires a little more setting of the stage than usual. Maybe it was the pleasure of introducing the teachers of our children, but I am celebrating this morning the great pleasure of simply knowing things, of going away from any kind of human encounter a little wiser than when we came to it. 2 weeks ago, fairly conventionally at least, I honored mothers. Last week, I tried to define Christian conduct under the familiar imagery of salt and light and leaven. But this is a sermon off the beaten track about the things we know that aren't so. A kind of backdoor approach to the worth of wisdom by reminding ourselves that unless we hang on tightly to some healthy skepticism, a lot of what we think is true will not be true at all. So here goes. We won't bother with what are called chimney corner scriptures, which are quotations we have heard since childhood and think are in the Bible, but are not. Things like, money is the root of all evil. A verse we love to recite when somebody else wins the lottery. It's a common misquotation of a much more sensible statement, which is in the Bible, that it is the love of money that is the root of all evil. That way of putting it takes some of the fun out of life, because it means that even the poorest of us can make that mistake and love and lust after money as much as anyone who has a ton of it. We should have known better anyway. Money is only a thing. Morality springs from how we feel about it and how we use it. The way the verse is often quoted is inaccurate and obscures the fact that what the apostle said is actually a challenge to every one of us. There is an even stronger fixation about another false idea. Think about the Christmas Eve pageants you've seen, or the nativity scenes in front of churches. Mary and Joseph, a baby in a straw-filled box, an angel or two, three wise men in long robes, a live donkey if it's an ambitious church, maybe a couple of sheep if some deacon has a flock. You can juggle things a little, but you must never try to go with two wise men, or four, or five, because one thing firmly fixed in the tradition is that there were three of them. I've pointed out in classes with you that Matthew doesn't tell us how many there were. There is no hint of three wise men anywhere between the covers of the Bible. And that this is another example of the things we know that aren't so. Now, if I had to guess, why we settled on three, I would say it might be because three has been a sacred number in Christian history. Always a good bet when one isn't sure of the exact figure. Or maybe because the wise men, two or five or whatever, brought three different categories of gifts. We really have no idea. But to show you how religious legends expand, once everybody was sure that there were three wise men, it seemed only logical that the three of them should have names, something the Bible omitted to give them. And so somewhere down the line, they became known as Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. And as imagination ran wild, the astrologers from the East became no longer magi, but kings. You know, we three kings of Orient are. And you know the next line as the children sing it. They became kings, which made a good story, better yet, by suggesting that even royalty came from afar to bow down before the King of Kings. If you would be wise, never underestimate the power of devout Christians to improve on the story. Somebody even decided that it would be nice if these three wise men represented different races that came to kneel at the crib of the child. So they began to be represented in art as brown and yellow and white. And a black man, predictably, makes an appearance after a while in art. What better example could you want of how we sometimes have to peel off layer after layer of fancy from a biblical story before we can read it the way it was? Maybe on second thought, there is a better example after all. If I were to pass out slips of paper in a crowded bus or a restaurant or even in a church, even in this extraordinarily intelligent church, and ask people to write what they think the phrase "the Immaculate Conception" means as a religious term. Want to think about it for a moment? Most of them, if they were Protestants, but oddly enough, even many Catholics would say that it describes the virgin birth of Jesus. The truth is that it is a theory about the birth of his mother. And if you want a marvelous example of how doctrines develop in response to a perceived need for them, listen very carefully to the evolution of certain articles of faith in the early church. After the church was firmly settled in the idea that Jesus was born of a virgin, so that his entrance into life would be miraculous and have nothing to do with sex, another doctrine began to develop. Since Joseph was out of the picture, no hereditary sin could be passed on from him. But that still left his mother, who carried him for 9 months and gave birth in what seems to have been a perfectly normal way. What if some hereditary weakness or taint of blood passed from this young woman to her son? That would be dreadful. Well, the fertile minds of folk with worlds of time to fix such things came up with a solution. Out of absolutely nothing you can find in the scripture, they developed a doctrine that pushed the miraculous back into the conception of Mary herself. Mary's mother conceived Mary immaculately, which took care of any possibility that sinful nature might be transmitted when Mary got older and gave birth to her firstborn son. So we start with the virgin birth, and then we go backwards to the Immaculate Conception. And now I want to show you how we go forwards. What's been said already surely is ingenious enough to give us some food for thought. But listen to this. As the years passed, it occurred to devout adorers of Mary that since she herself had been conceived in a miraculous purity of the flesh and had later preserved that purity in the miraculous birth of a son, it only made sense for her to leave this world without having her flesh be corrupted in a grave. And so the church came up with the doctrine of, quote, the bodily assumption of Mary, meaning quite simply that instead of the usual death and burial, Mary was lifted up bodily, whole, pure, preserved, into the presence of God. Now, I understand and sympathize with the medieval wish to elevate and adore the one they called with fervent piety the Mother of God. But if the evidence of the Bible is important in such matters, then these are two more examples of the things we know that aren't so. But it's wise never to smile at the oddities far from home and overlook our own. We claim the Pilgrims and Puritans as our direct religious ancestors, but there are plenty of myths about those people, some perpetrated by others who judge them too harshly, some by us who try to make them wiser and more tolerant than they really were. The word puritanical is not a compliment. It suggests a person who thinks that anything that's fun must be sinful and who rarely risks a smile. It's not quite fair to the Puritans. Far from being the grim and repressed people Nathaniel Hawthorne depicts in The Scarlet Letter, written 200 years afterwards, they found a considerable amount of fun in life. Excavations at Salem, at the home of the Reverend Samuel Parris, have revealed hundreds of broken wine bottle fragments, one with his initials on the seal, along with many beef and pork bones and many clay pipe bowls and stems. The early American Puritans drank wines and ales and did so heartily, to quote some of the contemporary accounts. They ate well when they could, and they certainly had no objections to the pleasures of smoking. They didn't always dress in stark black and white either, although our grade school memories are always of sober-faced men and women with tall black hats and simple dresses. If you read serious, scholarly, well-researched histories instead of the easy caricatures passed down to us, They liked bright colors and games. And instead of being anti-intellectual and anti-science, they were the people who founded Harvard University, the first in America, with a charter that said its objective was the advancement of good literature, arts, and sciences. Delight in intellect, in the pure joy of a free and open mind, is a congregational heritage I hope no one ever talks us into giving up. We certainly had some bad days early on when a few of the religious zealots continued a European tradition and for a short time spent their energies hunting and hanging witches. But that too gets overstated. 20 were hanged as witches in that awful year of 1692 in Salem. But in England alone, one witch finder was responsible for 300 hangings in less than 2 years. 4 Quakers, regrettably, were hanged in Boston. But under Elizabeth I of England, 3,000 dissidents died in prison. The Puritans did indeed banish Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson, but in England they might well have been beheaded for less heresy than they spoke in New England. And as bad as Jonathan Edwards' famous sermon was, it was not delivered to the colonial Puritans, as people often carelessly think. That hellfire and damnation diatribe called sinners in the hands of an angry God was actually spoken in 1741, more than 120 years after the landing of the Mayflower. It was a revival sermon. And along with some others like it, it probably cost Edwards his job at the Northampton Church. He was dismissed in 1750 because of the severity of his doctrines. But we have some favorable mythologies of our own, and you won't like this quite as well as that, which need adjustment. You've seen the Thanksgiving Day pictures of the resolute pilgrims on their way to church with guns on their shoulders, and underneath the caption, the heart-stirring, patriotic caption, "To these we owe our fundamental liberties." Well, not quite. John Winthrop, first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and one of the most famous and influential of the early Puritan leaders, once said of democracy that he accounted it, quote, "the meanest and worst of all forms of government." He didn't trust the average man that much. Neither the pilgrims who came on the Mayflower, nor the larger group of Puritans who came along 10 years later, had any notion of establishing the kind of political system we got after the American Revolution. They simply wanted to be left alone to establish their own form of authoritarian theocracy. And for a while, they were not much easier on dissenters than had been the hated kings of England. The Bay Colony, in fact, in its Body of Liberties of 1641, made blasphemy a crime punishable by death. They grew out of it, but it took a while. I'm suggesting to you that if we are wise, we always have to temper our worship of our own heroes. One last swipe at something we know that isn't so. Pay no attention to those ultra-fundamentalist Christian friends of ours who, with good or devious intent, try to tell you that our founding fathers were all devout believers who would happily belong to their churches if they were alive today. As I've mentioned at length in another sermon some years ago, the most active ones were tolerant deists with views that would get them branded immediately as heretics in the very churches that now invoke their names. Well, enough already, as my grandson says. The point is that there is an astonishing amount of misinformation abroad in the world, and no one can save you from it but yourself. Be calmly critical about most things you hear, including sermons from this pulpit and every other pulpit, and fulfill what is still one of the most valuable promises in the world, no matter how often you have heard it quoted: you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. That is the word this morning from God's darling and delight, wisdom herself.